From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. The call says it all.
Swinging a ground ball to second base. Pokey Reese has it. He throws to first, and the Red Sox have won the American League pennant. They mob Allen Embry on the mound. The Boston Red Sox have pulled the greatest victory in team history.
Yep, it's true. The Red Sox in the World Series. They beat the arch-rival Yankees in dramatic fashion, coming back to take the series after losing the first three games. The Red Sox story is, well, legendary. The franchise hasn't won a World Series in 86 years, ever since Babe Ruth was sent packing to the Yanks. Since then, season after season has started with hope and ended in disaster. Freud would have a field day. Writers already have. But this October, Kurt Schilling and company are determined to write a new chapter. They'll have to beat another storied franchise, the St. Louis Cardinals, who clinched their own World Series ticket last night in a win against the Astros.
On the ground, a second. And for the first time since 1987, the St. Louis Cardinals are going to the World Series.
So far, the Cardinals have held all the cards. The Sox have struck out twice to the Redbirds in 1946 and 1967. 37 years later, the Red Sox hope for a reversal of fortune. Tonight on Point, hope, heartache, and history. It is time to play ball. And so we put it to you. Will you be glued to the tube watching the World Series? How do you rate this historic matchup? And what is it about the Red Sox saga that is so compelling? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have fielded a full team for this hour. Leading off is Dave Kindred, longtime columnist with the Sporting News. Dave is the author of Glove Stories and has the enviable task of covering the World Series. He's joining us from Burlington, Massachusetts. Dave, welcome.
Thank you very much, Dale. My pleasure.
Well, let me start with the kind of an obvious question, I guess. When the Sox were down 3-0, did you think there was a chance in the world that they were going to be able to come back from that?
Well, actually, I did, but only when Rivera failed in the ninth. I mean, when Mariano Rivera doesn't do it, there's trouble. He didn't do it in the fourth game. They were three outs away from the sweep. Then didn't do it in the fifth game, and you begin to think that these Yankees... Well, I never thought the Yankees were as good as the Red Sox to begin with. I thought Boston was always the better team throughout the year. But when that happened, then there was a crack in the empire.
Hmm. Well, at this point, the Red Sox may have the momentum. Do you think they have the better team?
I think these teams are much alike. I like both of them. They're both very good offensive teams. They're both very good defensive teams. The Red Sox, you know, if Schilling's ankle is good and if Pedro is better than he has been, Boston's pitching should be a little better than St. Louis. But I think they're both comparable teams and they're very good teams. It should be a very good series. It reminds me a lot, actually, of the 75 series. When Cincinnati came here, I think the Cardinals are the best team in the National League since that big red machine of the mid-70s, since Cincinnati came here in 75 and won.
Well, tell us what to look for early on in this series. What are you going to be looking for as these two teams take the field?
Well, I think you have to, you know, a knuckleballer is always questionable. You know, how good is Tim Wakefield going to be? Some days knuckleball works, other days it doesn't work.
And that's something St. Louis, I understand, isn't accustomed to seeing very much.
Well, no one's accustomed to seeing it much, Dale. It's a rare thing. When Wakefield was sensational in the last game that he pitched, Veritek, you had to feel bad for Veritek. He couldn't catch it, so how's anybody going to hit it? But whether he can do that in this game under this pressure, who knows? I expect the games to be high scoring. I think there'll be 7-5 games, 8-6 games. I think it'll be great baseball to watch.
What's the danger, do you think, that both teams are going into this just absolutely exhausted? I mean, certainly, especially the Sox, after their tough four games, there have to be a lot of tired arms on the Boston side.
Well, that may be so, but there's a long winter. You know, there's adrenaline in a World Series. I don't think it'll matter. It's you know, they're not pushing each other around. They're playing baseball, you know, and baseball doesn't demand that much from you physically. They do it for 250 days a year. And I don't think they'll be exhausted mentally either. I think they'll both be floating. I think that certainly the Red Sox have every reason to be floating, having done something that no one in 101 years has ever done. And St. Louis was much the best team all year. You know, they got a scare in Houston. They survived that. I think they're coming in here on a high, too. I think there won't be a long face there from anybody. No one's going to be tired for this.
Well, Dave, stay with us. I want to bring into the conversation now Lee Montville, former longtime sports columnist for the Boston Globe and senior writer for Sports Illustrated. He's also the author of Ted Williams, Biography of an American Hero. He's with me here in the studio, and welcome, Lee.
Hi, Gail. Hi, David.
Hi, Lee. Everyone, by the way, should run out and buy two of those Ted Williams books.
Well, I've got one sitting right in front of me right now.
It's a great book.
Does look impressive. Mm-hmm. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, and it must be said, a diehard Sox fan. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Gail. Nice to be with you, and hello, gentlemen.
Well, Lee, let me get your take on how historic is this? Obviously, it's a big day for Red Sox fans.
Well, it's historic around here. I mean, the saga has just been going on forever, you know, since 1918, and it's been getting better and better and better and better. And beating the Yankees is a step, but it was interesting today the debate whether the curse of the Bambino is gone by beating the Yankees or by winning the World Series. I think it's by winning the World Series for sure.
So they're not there yet.
No. The general euphoria around here is just terrific.
Jack, you've been waiting a long time for this, obviously. Were you about to give up, or did you figure it really just had to be a matter of time?
I was ready to give up. I mean, that 19-run game, I mean, I just was ready to... But, you know, to be a Red Sox fan, existentially, you have to learn how to manage failure. It's sort of a tutorial for life in that respect. You get used to dealing with, you know, the alternation between hope and resignation. Mm. And you protect your feelings by being resigned in advance. And then, resigned as you are, you start to wildly hope. And then you're just all set up for the big fall. So it's quite an experience being a... It's not the sissies being a Red Sox fan.
This is true. And also, there have been so many twists and turns in this road. I mean, I don't know about you, but I was hyperventilating even in the ninth inning of the last game,
absolutely.
10-3 with two outs.
You know? Absolutely. I mean, of course, anything can happen.
Absolutely.
And it has.
Frequently. Well, Lee Montville, let me ask you about the Cards. They have won, 105 games this season. They're seen as a balanced team, good pitching, good hitting, good fielding. What are you going to be looking for?
Well, I don't know anything about the Cardinals. When you live in Boston, it's an American League city, and everything happens in the National League. It's like happening in Poland. You know, they have these obscure rituals. They let the pitcher hit and do things like that. And, you know, I just know the Cardinals from this past series, and they do seem to match up very well with the Red Sox. And you see, it's odd because it's like you travel through Poland, but you come across some people you know from the American League, like Tony La Russa, and you go, oh, there's Tony. He lives here in Poland now. It's kind of weird.
So is this an East Coast phenomenon? I mean, is the rest of the country as excited and energized about this, or is this really Boston-centric?
Well, Boston and New York-centric, I think, through the last series, you know. But seeing as New York and a little bit of Boston controls the media for the country, I think they shoved it down people's throats. And because they're such old franchises, too, that a lot of transplants have moved. You know, I mean, you see both of those teams when they play on the road, there's always a real knot of people cheering for them. And if they win... those people kind of take over these stadiums in other cities. So they are kind of national teams.
And Dave Kindred, what do you think about that?
Well, Dale, I went shopping in a mall in Fredericksburg, Virginia, 2 weeks ago and ran into a young man, 25, with his wife and his 5-year-old child. The young man was wearing a Boston Red Sox cap. So me being a sports writer, I'm in Central Virginia, and here's a Boston Red Sox fan, so I have to chat him up to find out why this is. Turns out he's from Rhode Island, but he'd moved to Virginia. And the last thing he did was talk to his son. He says, "Chad, tell the man what we think of the Yankees." And this little boy goes, "Boo." I think Lee is right. I mean, these franchises both are national franchises, the Yankees and Red Sox. I think everyone has some sort of feeling for them. It's also interesting in hearing Jack talk about the poor, poor Red Sox, how you have to suffer for 86 years. Well, I grew up within 100 miles of Wrigley Field.
Ah, so you know about suffering.
The Chicago Cubs haven't been in a World Series for, 59 years now, let alone lost them all. So let's don't, you have to share the suffering, Jack.
That's for sure. And you've had heartbreaking, as in last year, heartbreaking defeats.
Well, and we have the billy goat curse there. We don't mess around with human beings. It's an animal there.
And, Jack, do you have something to tell us about the history of the Cards?
Well, of course, this is one of the oldest franchises. But, you know, what strikes me is the parallel in the history of the cities. You know, they were both made second cities in the 19th century. Boston, by the completion of the Erie Canal, which made New York the leader in everything, really, from population to opulence, and put New York right at the head of a commerce stretching deep into the Midwest. That was the end of Boston right then. And St. Louis was the first and really only city of the West right up until the 1850s, when the Mississippi River, which it sits athwart, became eclipsed by the railroad, as the city did by the Rome of the railroad, Chicago. And in the 20th century, it's an interesting parallel there. Boston declines to about 1950. St. Louis booms to about 1950. They both sharply lose population after that with the urban flight of the 50s and 60s. St. Louis goes from 850,000 people to about 350,000 today. Boston to only from about that to 650,000. But Boston gets new people in. It gets a revival starting in the 60s. And things really pretty much go from bad to worse for St. Louis in terms of its revival right up into current times. I was recently talking to a city planner for St. Louis who says that the city has an infrastructure now for nearly 1 million people, and it has about a quarter of that population, or a third of that. And so it's recruiting people to come there, and one of the groups it's recruiting are Bosnian refugees. And they're going over to Bosnia, or they were during the Clinton time, and saying, "We got a great city here. Would you like to work there?" And people were settling. They were essentially resettling St. Louis.
Dave, we just have about a minute and a half before we have to take a break, and I'm curious about your take on the St. Louis fans. Are they as rabid as the Boston fans?
I doubt that, because they have had some success to temper their defeats. But certainly baseball, you know, as Jack is pointing out, St. Louis used to be the western outpost of Major League Baseball and also the southern outpost. So St. Louis has a great fan base, a traditional fan base that reaches both west and south, and they were kind of a regional franchise long before anyone thought of that. So there's a deep and profound respect and admiration for baseball in St. Louis.
Well, Dave Kindred, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dave Kindred is columnist for the Sporting News, covering the World Series. Lucky man. We're talking this hour about hope and heartache and history, the matchup between two heroic teams, the Red Sox and the Cardinals. So what do you think? Have the Red Sox already won the World Series by beating the Yankees? Have the Cardinals been overlooked because they play in the middle of the country and not on one of the coasts? Sox fans, have you enjoyed watching the playoff games, or has it been excruciating? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's the Red Sox boogie. Sing about the team that no one could beat. It's the Red Sox boogie. Sending every other team down to defeat. It's the Red Sox boogie. Sing about the team that no one could beat. It's the Red Sox boogie. Sending every other team down.
This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the World Series, the hype and the hope and the heartache. The Red Sox have come so close so many times. Who could ever forget what happened in Game 6 of the 86 World Series against the New York Mets? Here's how the legendary announcer Bob Murphy called it.
Mookie Wilson still hoping to win it for New York. 3-2 the count. And the pitch by Stanley. And a ground ball trickling. It is a fair ball. Gets by Buckner. Down the third night. The Mets will win the ball game. The Mets win. They win.
Unbelievable. The Red Sox in stunned disbelief.
Stunned disbelief indeed. The Sox went on to lose that series in another disappointment. But that was then, and this is now. Are you a member of Red Sox Nation, or are you flocking to the Cardinals? Do you remember when these teams met in 67? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Lee Montville, former columnist for the Boston Globe and Sports Illustrated, and author of Ted Williams, Biography of an American Hero, and also with our own Jack Beatty, news analyst and devoted Red Sox fan. And joining us now from Scituate, Massachusetts, is Jim Lonborg, former Red Sox pitcher. He was the Cy Young Award winner in 67 and won two games for the Sox in the World Series against the Cardinals. After his career was over in baseball, Lonborg went on to dental school. So welcome, Dr. Jim Lonborg.
Thank you, Gail. It's nice talking with you.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And also with us from Hyannis, Massachusetts, is your impossible dream teammate, former second baseman Mike Andrews. And since retiring from baseball, he's served as the chairman of the board for the Jimmy Fund that supports the fight against cancer at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and is the official charity of the Boston Red Sox. So, Mike, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you, Gail, Jim, Lee, Jack.
The whole crowd. The whole We're all crowd. Here. Jim, I want to start with you. I read a great quote that you had said. You said that pitching in the World Series is the greatest, that there is so much adrenaline flowing, you forget all the aches and pains that have built up during the season, and you just go for it. I suspect that's probably a good quote for Kurt chilling to hear.
Well, anybody who's in that situation knows that it's the end of the line. It's what you've been waiting all summer for. It's what you dreamed about when you were a little kid. And there's nothing, no reason to hold back. Adrenaline's a wonderful thing, and it definitely takes a lot of aches and pains that you might have and puts you in a position to compete.
Remind us what the 67 series was like for you. I mean, you threw a complete game to clinch the pennant race, and then what happened against, gulp, the Cardinals?
You know, it was, you know, I think Mike can attest to this, to, you know, we were just so happy to have, you know, won the season and to beat the Twins and to be in the World Series. It was almost anticlimactic for us. We were having so much fun. I think it reminds me a lot of what's going on with these guys today, is that they're having so much fun playing baseball and enjoying the wonderful art of the game, that once we got out there, you know, we just tried to have fun and beat somebody. And I don't think anybody gave us much of a chance to beat them. But all of a sudden, the sixth and seventh game came around, and we're right in the middle of the hunt. So it kind of got serious at the end.
And Mike Andrews, what's the moment that lingers in your mind from the 67 series?
Well, I agree with Jim wholeheartedly. I think that very much like the Red Sox now are coming out of that Yankee series that was so emotionally and physically draining, the question will be, can they get themselves up to that level again that they were at toward in those last four games particularly? Because I feel like with us, we, of course, came down to the last day of the season with three teams still very much all tied, really, trying to weed out who is going to go to the World Series or who's going to be in a playoff. And I think by the time that last game was over, we were so mentally and physically drained that it took us a little while to get ourselves back together. On the other side of the ledger, the St. Louis Cardinals had run away with the National League and had been able to tweak their lineup, rest their pitching, get everything organized. At least this year we're going in and the Cardinals face the same thing that the Red Sox do. So it's a much leveler playing field as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And Jim Lonborg, if you agree with that, whose responsibility is it? Is it the teams? Is it the managers to make sure that everybody's really going to be up for this game? Or no question, they're going to be up for it?
You put on that uniform and you get, I think one of the hardest things that happens is trying to deal with all the party atmosphere that surrounds you, the new reporters, the new reports, the number of interviews you're going through, and you just want to get all that over with and put on your uniform and get out on the field and do what you know you love to do, which is to go out and hit the ball and throw the ball and get people out and make catches. They're just waiting for all of this, the pregame stuff to get over with so they can get out and play. They're both tired, but once those lights come on and once that new team comes out on the field, they're going to be ready to play.
All right. Go ahead.
Can I just ask a question of Mike Andrews? This is Jack Beatty.
Sure, yeah.
Mike, could you just give us a word picture of what it was like hitting against the fearsome Bob Gibson, the St. Louis Cardinals?
I still have dreams that he's going to come out of retirement and hit the seventh game of this one. There was a perfect example of a big advantage they had, because as all of the people who followed back then knows that Jim couldn't even, our Cy Young Award winner couldn't even begin the World Series because he had pitched the last day and therefore we had to go another route. And they had rested Bob Gibson, who that year had actually broken his foot during the season, so he didn't even have a full year. But he was probably as good as he's ever been when he got to the World Series. It was just perfect timing. He wasn't overtired. They were able to get him his innings in, and I guess that's a long-winded way of saying I'm so glad I'll never have to do that again.
Well, thank you both, Jim Lomborg and Mike Andrews, so much for sharing your memories with us. And before I let you go, Jim, quick prediction?
I think this thing is going to go all the way to seven games. I think the Red Sox are going to have the edge. I think their pitching staff is a dream come true for all of us here in New England, and I think that that's going to be the key.
Okay, and Mike?
Well, I'm a emotionalist here. I'm going to I thought in 67 we couldn't possibly lose because that was the end of the perfect season. But I think this is the only way to truly break the curse is to beat the team that's beat us twice, beat the Yankees. So I'm going with the Red Sox probably in six or seven.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
And I want to bring into the conversation now someone from the other dugout, Mike Shannon. He played third base on the 67 Cardinals team that bested the Sox that year. His home run off the Sox's Gary Bell was the key blow in Game 3. And since 1982, he's been a Cardinals broadcaster for KMOX. He's joining us now from Fenway Park. And, Mike, welcome. And I would imagine you've been hard at work today.
You got all of that correct, 100%.
All right. So how are you, what do you see when you survey these two teams?
I see a lot of offense. These are two just dynamite-packed offenses that usually are going to score and score big time. The pitchers are going to have to pitch extremely well if they're going to get it done, and I look for the series to go to the bullpens, as it usually does. But I think the key for the Red Sox pitching is that they're going to have to try to combat the left-handed batters we have in Walker and in Jimmy Edmonds because of that short porch out in left field. They both can hit that way, and if they pitch them inside, they both can pull the ball. So that's going to be the problem for the Sox pitching the way I look at it.
All right. Well, if you were coaching the Cards, what would you be saying to them?
If I was coaching who?
The Cards.
Oh, you don't have to say anything to them at this time of the year. They've been waiting their whole lives. They've been waiting since Babe Ruth League. They've been waiting since Little League, all of it, to get right here. So you don't have to say anything to them. They're going to go out there, and they're going to play their hearts out.
They're going to do just fine. All right, let's go to our phone lines now. Mike, stay with us for just a moment, if you will. We want to hear from Judy, who's on the line from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Judy. Welcome.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Never been on the radio before, but I'm so fired up about the Red Sox, I had to call.
Well, we're glad you did. Share some of your memories with us.
Well, I'd like to take you back to my perspective of the 1986 World Series, where I was at Game 6 in Shea Stadium, the only time I'd ever been to Shea Stadium. Drove down middle of the night before, bought scalp tickets for standing room only, the whole nine yards. You know, when you're 27, you can do stuff like that. And I remember Game 6 like it was yesterday. As a matter of fact, only until the last 5 years, I stopped crying about it when I thought about it. But in the moment, in New York that night, people who were Red Sox fans who gathered to go to that game didn't really feel like, you know, that was the colossal blow that it's come to mean in the subsequent years. And what I'm thinking about is when we call it Mookie Wilson's ground ball to first. We don't call it the night the ball went through Buckner's legs. We call it Mookie Wilson's ground ball to first. When that happened and they lost that game, they lost Game 6, The feeling in the moment amongst Red Sox fans was we came so close to winning that game that the next night was going to happen. So that error, that moment, that was really overshadowed by the hope of the next night. And as I remember, Game 7 had a two-night rainout. So they had Game 6, they had a rainout, and then Game 7. In talking to New York fans and talking to Mets fans, they were scared to face Bruce Hurst. So confidence was high going into that game. Well, everybody knows what happens. I think they get out to a 6-0 lead. They lost the game. They lost the World Series. But the time between the World Series and spring training never felt shorter to Red Sox fans because that team was so phenomenal. Roger Clemens, right before his prime, everybody on that team coming back from 87.
Sure.
You really felt like 87 was going to be a great year, and it ended up being not, of course.
All right, Judy. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story. And Lee, I guess just one more illustration of the great resilience of Sox fans. I want to ask you, though, about we've heard so much about the sort of ghost of Babe Ruth. I wonder if maybe you see the ghost of Ted Williams, you know, hanging over this series somehow. What do you think Ted would make of all of this?
I don't know. Ted's only World Series was that 1946 World Series against the Cardinals, and he had a terrible time of it. He only hit 200. He didn't hit anything bigger than a single. The Cardinals had wound up in a playoff for the National League Championship, and so that it was a best 2 out of 3. So Red Sox management wanted to keep the players sharp, and they scheduled 3 exhibition games here in Boston against an American League All-Star team, including Joe DiMaggio. And in the first game, Ted got hit in the arm with a pitch, and he had a bad elbow for the whole series. Mm-hmm. And he also had big troubles with Harry Burkine, who was the left-handed pitcher there.
Yeah. So if he were sitting in the dugout now, you know, how would he measure up?
Oh, he's the greatest hitter of all time. He'd measure up, very well, you know.
Is the game the same as it was in his time?
No, it's changed a bit, but he was doing things, you know, with his head that they do with computers now in charting pitches and figuring out tendencies, and he would have done just fine.
Lay, that World Series had a Buckner moment too, didn't it?
Sure it did. Sure it did. In the final game, the score is tied 3-3. Enos Slaughter on first, and there's a single, and Slaughter's running, and he runs all the way to home on a single. And there's always been controversy about Johnny Pesky at shortstop taking the relay and whether he wasn't prepared for Slaughter to be running, and if he hesitated a little, and Slaughter scored the run, and they won the game 4-3. But there was a fate thing there, too. The Red Sox had tied the game in the top of the inning. Dominic DiMaggio had hit a double and slid into second base and pulled a muscle, and he was replaced by Leon Culberson in center field, and it was Leon Culberson who fielded the ball and threw the ball to Pesky, and so he wasn't the normal guy out there.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. From Somerville, Massachusetts, we have George on the line. Hi, George.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I'd like to say hi to Mike Shannon. First of all, I didn't realize he was going to be on.
Well, I'm afraid he had to leave us. He had to go back to work. I'm sure you can understand.
I grew up listening to him.
We'll pass it along.
I just want to say, you know, pity the poor St. Louis living in Boston.
That might be you.
That's me. I took my life into my hands today and walked around town in a Cardinal jacket.
Now, did anybody hassle you?
I got a lot of funny looks, a lot of quizzical looks. It's not like I was wearing a Yankee shirt.
Yeah.
But it was, you're a Cardinal fan? It's like they've never seen one before.
So are you going to be in the ballpark, or you'll be watching from home?
I'll be watching from home, unfortunately.
All right.
But I want to say that for the first time in my life, I'll be happy whoever wins the World Series.
All right. Well, I suspect there will be a lot of people who feel that way. Thanks so much for the call, George. To Chapel Hill, North Carolina now, we want to hear from Carrie. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to say one thing about whether or not Red Sox fans who are getting excited about this phenomenal fight there's been between the Red Sox and the Yankees are fair-weather friends or not. And I just don't think they are. I'm actually excited that people who may never have been into baseball before and may never have gotten excited about the Red Sox and their history are because of the tournament that we just saw.
All right, Carrie, I think that's probably true of a lot of people. Thanks for calling. And I want to put that to you, Lee, because
nobody will pay any attention to someone who calls it a tournament in baseball.
That's okay. We'll forgive her. She said she was a new fan. You know, that's all right. I want to ask you about this notion that football has now become, you know, baseball is supposed to be America's pastime. There are those who say, no, it's become football. People are really more interested in football, that baseball's too slow, there are too many games, and so on. But when you really start watching the game and the strategy, and when you can look at it as kind of three-dimensional chess, that really changes the experience, I think. The more you know about the game, the more you get into it.
Oh, very much so. You know, I mean, there's people who have spent their lives trying to figure out baseball. You go down a rabbit hole there, and you're gone forever. Baseball, the best thing about baseball is that you can sit back. You sit back in your chair and watch it, and then the action brings you forward at certain moments. It's a very conversational game to watch, whereas football, you're kind of at the edge of your seat the whole time. I like baseball in the end in these great games in October. I mean, if you put a game from the middle of July against a football game, I'd probably watch the football. But these games are just fabulous. And playing the best of seven day after day after day, you get really involved with the characters and the little drama. I think it's kind of cool.
Or the big drama. I think there were a lot of tired people around Boston, around
New
England this
yeah.
past week. All of us getting to bed about 1 o'clock in the morning. All right. Jack, we're just going to take a break, and then we'll continue our conversation, so hold the thought. On the eve of Game 1 of the World Series, we are continuing our conversation about hope and hype and heart and history and all the other H words. So how do you rate this historic matchup between the Red Sox and the Cardinals? Red Sox fans, are you unabashedly cheering, or is your heart in your throat? And if you're not a Sox fan, are you hoping they still win just so you won't have to hear all of us Bostonians carping about the curse of the Bambino? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about hope and heart and history on the eve of the World Series. How do you rate this historic matchup, and what is it about the Red Sox that keeps fans hoping in the face of all the disappointment for all these years? Does it feel more real when the World Series is between teams with long histories rather than one-year wonders like the Diamondbacks and Marlins? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Lee Montville, former longtime sports columnist for the Boston Globe and senior writer for Sports Illustrated, also author of Ted Williams, Biography of an American Hero. And also joining us is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's go back to the phone lines now. We've got a lot of people who want to be part of this conversation. Michael first from Northeastern Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. What are your memories?
I have great memories. They go back to 1986. I am from Germany. I'm German. I'm married to Susan from Great Barrington, Mass. And at the time, we were married, and Susan was very pregnant with our first child when Game 6 took place at Chase Stadium. And when Buckner let the ball go through, I thought my wife was going to go into labor right there. And Baseball is a game of redeeming natures, and I couldn't be more excited for the Red Sox. My wife, after last year's crushing defeat, said she hopes that she lives to the day that the Red Sox win the World Series. I told her this year, this is the year. They're going to beat the Yankees. Don't give up hope. She was hyperventilating at Game 7 a couple days ago. I held her hand, and she settled down, and here they go. I think they're going to beat the Cardinals. It was exciting in 1986 to listen over American Armed Forces Network to Game 6 and Game 7 with her and to go through all the devastation. And as a German, I understand this game. Our sons play the game here, and it's wonderful to see everybody happy and smile.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael. Good to have you with us. And Lee, by the way, if my math is correct, then that child with whom she was pregnant is about 18 years old now. Now, you talk about waiting a long time.
Wow.
Because my son was just 2 months old, and I remember watching it with him in my arms, and he's 18. So, Lee, you were going to share a story with us about that Game 6 that is burned into our collective memories.
Oh, yeah. I was a columnist then for the Boston Globe, and these games are so late at night that you have to start writing your column sometime during the game, usually, to get it into the first editions. And so in about the sixth inning, I went down to the press room at Shea Stadium, and I had one of those old portable computers that was like the size of an accordion, you know. And I was typing out this wonderful thing about church bells pealing across the New England and people running down the streets and all that. And there were a whole bunch of guys doing this. And in the press room, there was a small black and white television with a bad vertical hold. And so it was flipping around, and they had the game on. And you could hear people go, oh, ooh. And so I would type a little bit more joy, and then, ooh. And then another bad thing, ooh. And finally, the ball went through Buckner's legs, and that was the end of that column. And for a weird reason, I don't know why, I kept it in that computer for about 2 years. And then one day I just pushed delete, and the words kind of flew off into the sky to Babe and to all the people, I guess.
Why did you hang on to it for that long? Just a reminder of that night?
I guess, or maybe it's that lazy thing that, you know, maybe they're going to win it. No, I'll have the column all set to go. You know, I'll just change the dates in here.
Yes, not so fast there, Lee.
That was a terrible thing.
Well, imagine, though, if it had made it into the paper. I mean, was there any chance of that if they had gone to press before the game was actually finished? That would have been pretty embarrassing.
Yeah, I was too slow to get it done that fast, I guess. I don't know. It's always a tricky thing. Everybody talks about how tired the ball players are with these long games and day after day. The sports writers are more beat up than the ball players. I mean, they have to write before the game, during the game, after the game. And the one after the game, it's like a 23-minute, you know, just dance. And you know, you have no idea what you're writing, what it's all about. And you're amazed that it comes out in English the next day.
Well, but on the plus side, you get to be there. So I think a lot of people would be happy to have that front row seat.
Yeah, but, I don't do that anymore, and it's better watching it even on television, you know, and just when the commercials come, you go out and get something to eat.
Back to our phone lines now to Wisconsin, Wanaki, Wisconsin. Paul's on the line. Hi, Paul.
Good evening. I was 9 years old in 1967, and I lived in Peoria, Illinois, which was kind of the fault line between Cub fans and Cardinal fans. And baseball was really the national pastime back then. We actually got to watch the day games at school. And they wheeled a black and white TV into the class. And, you know, we just didn't believe we were getting away with it. So we all just sat real quiet and watched the game as best we could and got our work done. But Boston had some great players, you know, some young men. Conigliaro.
Sure.
Tony, you know, C. He never did become the veteran that he could have been. But and then that 86 game, my wife was a big Mets fan. We were living in New Jersey, but we had made a date to get engaged that night. So we had a big concert to go to and a dinner. And she was almost resentful that I kept her out too late to miss the game. And then we turn it on and we're losing. And then the ball goes through his legs, and all of a sudden she was happy again, and we got married.
Well, I'm glad it worked out for you, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
It worked out for somebody.
Thanks again. Jack Beatty, where were you in 67 and 86? I imagine you were glued to your set, or were you actually there?
No, I wasn't there, but I certainly was glued to my set. And, you know, the 67 team you mentioned earlier was called the Impossible Dream Team. Picking up the theme song, the central song from Man of La Mancha, which was one of the big musicals of the day, but also because the team went from, I think, sixth or seventh the year before to first, and that was the impossible dream. And there was just all this sort of romance of impossibility that surrounded that team. And some of the people who were on that team have really become local figures here in a way that I don't really think of. You think of baseball players as scattering around, with Rico Petrocelli, Lomberg, Mike Andrews, others live around here and have really sort of grown up around or sort of been part of our lives in New England for a long time. That team was made very welcome here. I want to see I don't want to see Dan Shaughnessy, who's the great sports columnist for the Globe, write a sentence at the end of this World Series, just as the first sentence of his piece after the Yankees beat the Red Sox in the playoffs last year. His first sentence was, "Hamlet always dies, the Titanic always sinks, and the Red Sox always lose." Oh. Well, you know, yes. You write one of those sentences in your lifetime, and that's enough. Yeah. And, of course, the reference to the Titanic is that the Fenway Park was open the same month, if not the same day, the Titanic sunk. So,
To Sal now on the line from Boston. Hi, Sal.
I remember the 1986 World Series, and I definitely remember seeing the ball going through Buckner's legs. I was in high school at the time, definitely stuck in my head. Sort of always thought that the Red Sox would never make it, but after seeing them come back from behind this year, from so far back behind, they were, you know, pretty much counted out by everyone, including the announcers, that I don't know, since Game 7, I've just kind of been in a euphoric state where now I can just enjoy the game, you know, and I think they have a pretty good chance against the Cardinals. It's a pretty good, you know, matchup. And there's no one I have to hate anymore. I don't have to hate Bill Buckner. I don't have to hate Bucky Dent. I don't have to hate, Mark Bellhorn or, you know, somebody like that. So I can just enjoy baseball again.
All right. Good point, and we thank you for sharing that with us, Sal. What about that from the fans' perspective, Lee? I mean, you know, this has been such a one-note story for so long. You know, what are we going to have to complain about if they actually win the World Series?
I know. I sent emails to my friends who are Yankee fans.
Oh, I'm sure they loved hearing that.
Well, it was just the title was A Word of Advice. And I said, I've always found it helpful in these situations to go out and strangle a cat.
Yeah, probably hear from the ASPCA.
Probably
on that
hear
one.
From the ASPCA, but that's the nice thing that for once, you know, we get the girl. You know, we get it all kind of winds up nice for once, and even better, it winds up bad for them. All these Yankee fans. I mean, I was talking the other night, and they always compare the Yankees to IBM or General Motors. I compare them to Halliburton. You know, kind of dark and sinister. And, you know, has anyone ever seen Dick Cheney and George Steinbrenner in the same room at the same time, you know?
Oh, you do have dark thoughts, Lee Montville. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's really been a pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Lee Montville, legendary sports columnist for the Globe, now writing for Sports Illustrated. And for a photo gallery of highlights from the Red Sox-Yankees series, go to our website, onpointradio.org. And Jack Beatty, thanks so much for being with us and sharing your memories and knowledge, too.
Thank you.
In just a moment, one Red Sox fan wonders what other miracles we might see this year. This is On Point. Well, as you surely know by now, the World Series kicks off tomorrow night with Game 1 in Boston. But for some fans, the shock from the Red Sox's dramatic pennant victory still hasn't quite worn off. Boston native John Kenny is a writer, now based in New York, and in this radio diary, he wonders if the Red Sox could pull off such a stunning win to get to the World Series, what other miraculous events might soon grab headlines around the world?
I lived through 9 very difficult years as a Red Sox fan in New York City, and so the other night was both sort of shocking and cathartic. I kept waiting for them to lose so that I could write this piece, but they just kept winning. A buddy of mine who's a rabid Yankees fan and I watched, you know, all the games, and when they won, we kind of sat there in shock. I mean, I don't think I was alone in my shock. I mean, it's kind of amazing that, you know, the sort of the lead book reviewer of the Times has a piece in the front page of the sports section. I think her lead sums it up. There was a breakdown in cosmic order Wednesday night, Michiko Kakutani wrote. And I think that's how everyone feels, you know. I mean, if the Sox can beat the Yankees, coming back 4 straight games, then anything can happen anywhere in the world, actually. Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry, speaking to reporters aboard his campaign bus, said today that he thought President Bush was, quote, doing a great job. The president, he said, deserved 4 more years and wished him the best in the upcoming election. Campaigning in Iowa today, President Bush said, I wake up each morning and have absolutely no idea where I am, and that's why this country needs John Kerry's leadership. The president, who became emotional speaking of Mr. Kerry, praised the senator's war record in Vietnam, saying that he envied his courage, and also that he thought Mr. Kerry looked marvelous in a Navy uniform. So very, very handsome, the president added. The Fox network has announced a new addition to their 2005 schedule. The show, called You Make a Really Good Point, will feature co-hosts Bill O'Reilly and Al Franken, who were legally married yesterday in Massachusetts. Documentary filmmaker Michael Moore has pulled copies of his film Fahrenheit 9/11, claiming that he made most of it up. Mr. Moore, who has battled weight over the years, said, quote, I was angry because I was heavy and I waddled, and also because I had to shoot the movie on videotape and not real film, and it just kind of looks like crap, and also Charlton Heston refused to be in this one. And in Jerusalem today, at their weekly luncheon, PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat urged Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to, quote, take more land. The chairman was quoted as saying, we're not using it, and it seems such a waste if it's just going to sit there. Mr. Sharon thanked Arafat, but told him that Israel, quote, had plenty of land. He then offered him the deed to the city of Jerusalem. The chairman declined and paid for their lunch. And this just in, the Boston Red Sox have beaten the New York Yankees to advance to the World Series. Yankee owner George Steinbrenner, when reached for comment, said, I can't tell you how happy I am for the Sox. I love those guys. I love that city. It really is a much better city than New York.
Some miraculous, fictional headlines from writer and Red Sox fan John Kenny. He lives in New York. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Jane Manners, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. With help from Michael Garth and Lorne Madelon, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Gail Harris, in for Tom Ashbrook. From the studios of Boston University, this is On Point.